So that fame is an inward quality, glory is the outward quality. Burkhardt says, to this inward development of the individual corresponds a new sort of outward distinction, the modern form of glory. In the other countries of Europe, the different classes of society lived apart, each with its own medieval caste sense of honor. The poetical fame of the troubadours and minus singers were peculiar to the knightly order. But in Italy, social equality had appeared before the time of the tyrannies or the democracies. We there find early traces of a general society, having, as will be shown more fully later on, a common ground in Latin and Italian literature. What does that mean? It means the languages. Now notice that the Latin is the language of the ancient Romans. The Italian is the language of the Florentines of the day. For a while, people were mature in both Latin and Italian. The individuals began to choose more and more of the existential authenticity of the very language that they spoke in their world. But those who were being fed back into the hopper opted for Latin. In fact, most of the church-run universities required that you only use Latin, not the languages. One individual technique that was used to subvert this process was introduced as early as the 12th century. A man in England named Walter Mapes, who went under the pseudonym of Golias, left a heritage, and those who followed in his footsteps in using this technique were called the Goliardi, or the Goliards. And they used classical Latin to make up profane songs of love. And they would sing these songs, they're like the beginning of the troubadours. They would use the classical language to talk about individual love experiences on a very sexy level. None of this mythological stuff. Not interested in Aphrodite's smile. What about Mabel? Look at Mabel, man. And there she is. See, it's in a strategic way, a subverting of the glue that held the cycle together. Because a mythic horizon always is a language phenomenon, and the cosmic cycles only hold as long as the language is there. This is why the classic way out is the way of silence. The ultimate refusal is to use the language. Not going to use their language. The radical version of it is I'm not going to use any language at all. It's a radical solution. Here's where I have to interrupt Burkhardt and bring in, yet again, this is the third time I'm introducing this, just one page that I wrote for you at the beginning of the history section, and I read it to you again a couple of weeks ago, and I give it to you for a third time. Why the repetition? Because it doesn't occur to you, because you're learning. And it doesn't occur to you at first what's there. And only by reintroducing it is there this kind of accumulative penetration that the insight and the whole notion of consciousness led by thought is insight. The Greek word for it is pronaios. Prometheus is punished by the gods for giving to man the capacity for insight. What is the spark, the fire held in the fennel? Well, you can't hold physical fire in a fennel stalk. It's the spark of insight. That's the gift of fire that Prometheus brings to man. Foresight. Pranayas. Some of the esoteric Rosicrucian material is all to do with the pranayas of the Temple of Wisdom. And you can find those kinds of titles. Here's my writing for you. Only in history is the person free to act. On the mythic horizon, only roles are possible according to the mythic self-image, feeling-toned complex, and according to the meaning generated out of ritual comportment. However, after symbolic integration of that mythic horizon into the deep self-soul, then the radiant magic of consciousness can achieve the heretofore invisible, subconscious, heretofore, realm of the person. Once achieved, the person can now, artistically, veritable reality, live in the historical horizon. The cliche, quote, horizon of raised expectations, unquote, speaks of this flow. History is a transformational medium, media, in a kind of a Mobius continuity, and it has its complementarity to myth as a transformational medium. So that history is a complementation to myth. History and myth are complementary. And you must understand here that in the deep self, they're perfectly balanced, perfectly equipoised. That is, in the depths of ourselves, we are capable of balancing history and myth perfectly. There's another point of balance. There is another node of tranquility, which parallels and complements that of the deep self. Where is that? The outer expression of it. Somewhere out there in the universe. In the universe as a whole is a complementary, tranquil balance. That divinity is out there and is resonant with the divinity that's in here. Both are balanced nodes in this transformational Mobius continuity. History is thinking-toned complex, idea-oriented, person-based, in complement to myth, which is tribal-based. The carryover of tribal processes into history is the root source of tragic confusion for mankind. Now note here, it's not that the tribal comportment, I'm using it symbolically here, it's not that that is bad. In its own way, it's absolutely essential and necessary. It's continuing to use it after major transformation has happened. What once was nourishing is now poison. It's as simple as that. The Renaissance, the firstborn of modern Europe, is a mythic reincarnation of the old Roman Empire age, which itself was a reincarnation, reintegration of a golden age before it. The Romans had no historical idea that there was such a thing as a golden age before them. They thought it was a myth. They thought it was a property of the gods. Their historiography was not anywhere near the power of the historiography that's available to us today. We know now, we can name the civilizations that embodied the golden age before the Roman Empire. Not only that, we can name at least two levels before that, two golden ages before that. We can see that this indeed is a great cycle which does reoccur, but just because the cycle does in fact reoccur does not make it a cosmic pattern that has to reoccur. That doesn't follow at all. That's not logically there at all. It ain't necessarily so, saith Cole Porter. In fact, we can see from an inspection of the patterns of civilization that all civilizations that could be identified have followed this pattern to their own end. The great study where this was done is Arnold Toynbee's study of history. He said, I'm not going to study the history of this or that nation or anything. I'm going to study the development of civilizations. He identified 28 civilizations in world history, 27 of them are dead. And the 28th are owned, he characterized as being at the crisis of confidence. That if nothing is done, if no individual thought-directed action is done, this one will follow the way of the dinosaurs. Because they all have done this. But just because all have fallen in this way does not mean that we have to acquiesce in it. The silence of wisdom does not mean letting the junk go by the board. Toynbee used the phrase that it is a crisis of nerves. It has to do with consciousness, but it's a crisis of nerves. The colloquial phrase is that someone's nerve broke. They lost nerve. It's our contemporary way of saying what more traditionally would be a loss of soul. What did they lose? What broke? It's like there's a negative. The image is a negative of what happens. And so the image, the negative, the photographic negative of it says that something broke. It isn't that something broke so much is that a direction ceased and was absorbed back into an unbroken continuity, the mythic return. The characterizing of it as something broke is a statement made in terms of a mythic subsuming of that situation, and it's just an image of it. The actual fact is nothing broke, it's that a direction of freedom stopped happening. Instead of something breaking, it's just the opposite. You were factored back in. I'll give you a graphic presentation in an image tone of what I'm talking about. Ilya Kazan made a beautiful film, and John Steinbeck did the screenplay Viva Zapata, about the Mexican Revolution, Marlon Brando and Anthony Quinn. And in the beginning of it, the young Zapata, Marlon Brando, is causing trouble to the state run by the French, and there's a list of the names, and the military general puts a circle around Zapata's name. It's a symbolic way of saying we're gonna work you back in to our control. And of course he fights against it and so forth. And at the end of the film, Zapata himself has a list of rebels, and somebody's telling him, and he puts a circle around it, and he realizes what he's done. And he throws the paper away, and he throws the pen down, rips off the badges and the uniform, and walks out. It's Steinbeck Kazan's poignant, dramatic way of saying, this is the only way to stop the bulldozer. It's more than just the James Dean approach. It's the Gandhi approach. It's the Satyagraha approach. What happens is magical. One individual who maintains their freedom and does not leave will unravel the entire cosmic cycle. One angel who refuses to play heaven's game makes a hell. Well, in the negative image of it, it's a hell. Is it? That's from the heavenly viewpoint. What's the statement in Milton? I would rather rule in hell for one day than to serve an eternity in heaven. Notice the kind of complementation, the raising of the polarities to a point to where they are complementary, where there is, in fact, an opportunity that only happens in the individual in terms of their deep self, 100% capacity, or in the divine, universal, 100% capacity, the ability to exchange the ends of the opposition. The magical, unforeseen, trickster capacity. Instead of this obtaining, that obtains. And it happens instantaneity, in a spontaneous kind of a way. There's no time sequence. In Zen, it's known as sudden enlightenment. Or to the academic historians of the world, the Southern School. They don't get a robe and a bowl for that kind of talk. Notice that the individual, any individual, is in terms of the unconscious power of the state so destructive potentially that every one of them must be snuffed out in the sense of worked back into the clay. Now, if you have a pebble that doesn't break down and you work it back into the clay, what happens? Any place you put the pebble, it's still there. Anything you make out of the clay is still there. You're not going to be able to do anything with that clay as long as the pebble is there. You have to break the pebble down. You have to mash it into the clay in order for it, the clay, to be workable. The problem of authority and the individual, the problem of the individual and the state, seems at first to have the entire deck stacked in the state's hands, when the actual fact is that one joker changes the entire deck in every game that can be played with the deck. And the longer that the state uses the deck that has the joker in, the less that the games work out the way predicted. And the state has a crisis of confidence. It has a failure of nerve, not the individual. Now, that happens to be a universal law. Now, as long as the Buddha's methodology was operative for those people, there was no caste system. 1,000 years later, when the Buddhists became mulched back into a grander Hinduism, then there were caste systems again. What is a caste system? A quaternary? Just another season of junk. Endless. The permutations are endless. Once you see that it's the same old pattern, the charm of variation leaves. It gets easier and easier not to be suckered in. It gets easier and easier to say, this is another version of the old car that didn't work. They painted this one red. They put white sidewalls on this one. This one has 500 horsepower. It's the same thing. There's nothing but mechanical problems going to come out of this. You can't go anywhere in this. There's no place to go in this. What's the saying? The road never ends. This road out here is linked to every other road. It's just one road. Where you want to go to isn't on that road, no matter where that road goes. Don't take that vehicle. That's why the original Buddha characterized what he did as a vehicle. It's a vehicle. It's a different vehicle. It isn't the social, caste-structured vehicle that man had lived by. This is something. This is the individual. This is you, just you. And don't worry about all the rest of this. That's extraneous. All you need is yourself, diligently unfolded exactly as you are. And if you do that, it's the caste system that loses nerve. It's the whole state institution, no matter how it's set up, as an empire, as a kingdom, as a government, that cannot last. It cannot stand as long as an individual maintains their integrity. Why do you think that states or corporations or whatever go to all this trouble to make sure that everyone is weeded out? In the LA Times today, three students that pasted stickers over a Mao poster were sentenced. One of them got life imprisonment just for doing this. What's the big deal? The big deal is that any individual is a threat to the whole system. If you get interested in the characterization of this, the finest mind in our time was a woman, Barbara Hanna, whose book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, just meticulously lays the pattern out. And you can see in Barbara Hanna's brilliance exactly how the whole pattern always lays itself out the same way. What are the origins of totalitarianism? The fear of the individual. An individual. Any individual. Why are they afraid of you? What's the big deal? You're the pebble that's going to foil the forms that they're trying to make. It's not going to work. And, of course, the biggest subtle threat that they are able to heave at you is to say, look, you can't do it alone. And there aren't many of you, and they're getting fewer. What chance do you have? And, of course, the reply is the reply that Gandhi gave. As long as I stand, the British Empire is wrong. It stops with me. It stops right here. The authority that it has ends here at my physical body. And inside that is free land. And that free land's integrity has a resonance that every time I simply am, the echoes of that are sent out through the kingdom. It's like a fairy tale. And in this way, the fairy tales are exactly true. It only takes one hero to slay the dragon. It doesn't take a whole bunch of them. It doesn't take all of them. It takes just one. Notice that here, if you misunderstand, though, if you make the heroic quest a mythic cycle, you're going to be unconsciously subsumed back into the archetypal myth of the eternal return. Any myth is another thread that can be woven back in. You have to be careful not to make your individuation a patterned kind of a search. This is why the religious person is always careful not to get into a false habit. A discipline is not the same as a habit. As I was reminded by a Persian friend of mine just quite recently. And it's a spiritual insight. It is true. But without thought to guide, with its comparative complementation, you can easily fall into these kinds of parallel traps, not realizing that what you're doing is exactly landing you back. You didn't realize, didn't know. So there is a sense always that individuality is a seat of jeopardy. It's the chair called Siege Perilous in the Arthurian cycle. And notice the Arthurian cycle, the Arthurian mythology. The more legitimate the individuals in the Arthurian cycle, the more they threaten the kingdom. The more the round table is going to be broken up. If Lancelot follows his own heart's desire, the queen is compromised. And of course, the ultimate story in that, the point at which the Arthurian cycle breaks through to freedom is the story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, written at the time of Chaucer, is, and at the time of the Cloud of Unknowing and all the great English mystics, English Upanishads. England in the 14th century was amazing, 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 amazing place. Freedom, the breaking through of the whole Arthurian mythos into individual spiritual liberty. Is what happens there. And it's an end to the hypnotic effect. Now that whole hypnotic effect of the Arthurian cycle and mythos was reintroduced, of course, in Victorian times by Lord Alfred Tennyson, The Idylls of the King. And you find again in the generations raised on that they have all of this kind of nonsense that at one time in history may have had its place, but it certainly didn't have its place in the early 20th century. I guess the most noticeable poignancy of this was for women, of them being put on a pedestal by the man who sees them as the image of their perfection, but can't relate to them as a human being at all. Never occurs to them that she's got to eat. What? You're hungry. You'll eat anything. Well, the princess doesn't say that. Come on now, you can't be the right one. So long. Do you see the travesty of the individuality? Do you see that it's both massively there and also poignantly there at the same time? And the only way to deal with it is with both these qualities, the one and the many, as Plotinus says. You have to deal with them together. They occur together. They go together. The achievement of the individual self and the complementation to it, the amplification of consciousness to its fullness, which includes a stage where thought must take the lead. Foresight, insight, one must see, this is what will happen. This was what will occur. You don't have to go through that. You don't have to go that way. You don't have to run against those dead ends. You can see that that's going to be the way, go some other way, do something else. If all the ways lead to dead ends, then don't go anywhere. As Bertrand Russell said once, thought is wild, and men fear it like the plague, because thought can go anywhere. It can even recursively go back to its own origins in the deep self. And there experiences consciously the tranquility, the equilibrium, the balance that once it knew in a natural, integrative way and now remembers, oh, that's who I am. I'm not so-and-so. But to break out of that, to come back to the deep self in remembrance and not be caught into the mythic cycle that originally contributed to that deep self, that's a problem. That's a precariousness. I'll end with this. One of the great modern films is all about this. The film made in Brazil about 30 years ago, Black Orpheus. It's showing on Channel 28 at 10 o'clock tonight. And Black Orpheus is all about it. A man who struggles to try and be himself and finds himself on every turn co-opted back into the Orpheus man. But the myth doesn't care about you as an individual. It just cares about the way you perform the role which has been assigned to you. And if you play your role well, then that's well and good. But you may not change the script. And especially, you can't refuse to play in any script. That's just... Now notice that the most worldly of all actions in terms of pragmatic activity may be a kind of monasticism. The most pragmatic action sometime may be to excerpt oneself from the world. Paradox. Only thought, notice that feeling can't deal with that. Only thought can broach those aspects to your consciousness. Bring up the possibility. Maybe this way will work. It seems paradoxical. But maybe under paradoxical conditions, a paradoxical resolution will open the problem. In other words, the cure is always in the illness. The solution is always in the problem. And there are certain stages where the problem is paradoxical and the only resolution is paradoxical. Or like in Zen, Taquin's great insight, the problem may not be other than the fact that you think you have a problem. And by recognizing that there is no problem in reality, then there is no problem. That may be the solution, which is no solution at all. That's enough for today. Write your personal histories, please.